to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Later in the hour, I'll be talking to two attorneys working to lend a helping hand to those in need. This year's Book in Common author, Brian Stevenson, whose memoir about the criminal justice system, Just Mercy, is a New York Times bestseller. He will be appearing in Chico State's Lackson Auditorium on April 19th. Because Lackson Auditorium is completely sold out, Chico Performances is offering tickets to watch a live simulcast of the lecture from Harlan Adams Theater. Also, in the second half hour, attorney and author Carissa Phelps will be in the Bell Memorial Union on the Chico State campus next Tuesday for a free public training seminar on human trafficking. Her book is Runaway Girl, Escaping from Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. My first guest teaches a course on the Book in Common for Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on the Chico State campus. Brooks Thorlakson has helped build a community connection to the Book in Common program since 2008. She wrote and produced a video called The Biggest Book Club in the North State that focused on the Book in Common selection of 3 years ago. And you can see this video yourself on YouTube. Brooks Thorlakson, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. I'm so glad to be here.
The Book in Common is quite an event that involves the community, and I don't know if people really know what it is.
Well, the university came up with the idea back in 2000, and we've been picking a book and getting students on campus and faculty involved since that time. I say we do that. I was at the university. I retired 3 years ago. But the Book in Common was always sort of my baby, so I'm sure I'll forget and call it mine as we talk today.
I know you generously said the university started this, but was it your idea?
No, it was kind of an idea that was floating around universities at the time, and several people saw it. It was a way to bring university dialogue to a center, and so we decided to try it at Chico. And in the beginning, we tried to fit it into early freshman-level courses. It's had several sort of lives as time went on. But in 2008 and 9, when we picked Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen, we decided...
So you had Book in Common before that?
Yes, yes. Every single year, we had different books.
Well, what year, the very first year?
It was 2000, 2001. Mm-hmm. And every year, we picked a different book. And so over the years, we had... different courses, different faculty involved. But it was in 08 that we thought, this is really a cool idea for a community. And again, we were following national trends. NEH was offering funds for community reads, one city, one book. And so we decided to try to take the Book in Common at Chico State to the community. And we had wonderful response, not only from Butte Community College, but the Butte County Library System. Maureen Kirk, who was a supervisor, got the supervisors to declare the Book in Common, and the public schools jumped in. And Three Cups of Tea was an ideal book for that. I'm sure you'll recall, this was a book that had taken the U.S. by storm. Schools were donating pennies and to build schools in Afghanistan. So it was a great book to start that sort of community connection. Andy Holcomb was the mayor at that time. And he helped us kick it off with a big event in city down in the City Plaza. And since then, we've had several books that have had a real impact in the community. The next year, we picked The Soloist, a book by Steve Lopez. And that was a book that really created community connections between the university, Butte College, and the Torres Shelter and the Jesus Center here in Chico. Then we did a book
and
called...
And that brought up the issue of homelessness,
yes.
Which has continued to mushroom here in Chico as an issue. And Steve Lopez, the soloist that he wrote about, was a homeless man that he wrote about. And I interviewed him, and he said he was still in touch with this man.
Exactly, yeah. Steve Lopez was a columnist for a newspaper in L.A., and he noticed this homeless fellow on the street playing a cello. And it ended up that he was a friend. They became friends. Steve Lopez said in so many words that he got a PhD in the issues of homelessness by pursuing this fellow and finding out what was going on in L.A. And his book also opened up doors to the idea in Chico about homeless people and what we could do to help them. Another book we picked was Unquenchable.
And there again, something that was really in the forefront of everybody's mind.
Exactly. Water and the drought. And I would say at that time, we knew we were having water issues in Chico, but, you know, the creeks were still running. It wasn't the sense that we had last year where you had water companies cutting back and the state cutting back.
It hadn't reached the crisis point yet.
Exactly. Although when Robert Glennon was here, he's from the University of Arizona, he made it very clear that we were living on borrowed time. He did this wonderful talk in Lacson. And in fact, at one of his lines was, he looked out and Lacson was filled. He looked out and he said, "This is the biggest book club I've ever talked to."
And that was the name of your video that you made.
Exactly.
You wrote and produced the video.
Exactly.
And you call it the biggest book club in the North State.
Yes. And we called it Reading Water. We were trying to be clever, but it was about water. And I think one of the wonderful things about the book in common that year is it brought so many people from so many divergent points of view together to talk about an issue that clearly lived in all of us, the lack of water and what it would mean. We had people who were rice farmers talking to people who were environmentalists. The university's classes got involved with it. And Robert Glennon was quite impressed to see the kind of countywide interest and concern. And after he left, we actually were able to put together a video. And what it shows is the value of a book in common, that is, that it creates an opportunity for people of many different points of view to look at an issue, to talk about it in measured, calm ways, or not so calm, but to see that there is a common interest. We may have different, diverse solutions, but there's certainly a common issue.
That's a very well done video, and I encourage people, YouTube nowadays, you can get everything on YouTube. And so people might Google the biggest book club in the North State, Reading Water. And you wrote and produced this wonderful video. How hard was it to convince people to fund it? Because it had to be funded somehow.
Actually, Deborah Barger, who is one of the deans at the university, was in charge of an initiative for the university called the North State Initiative. And what is it that Chico State does for the North State? Well, the Book in Common is one of those projects that, while it is a Butte County project at this time, we imagined back then in 2008, 2009, that it could become a larger project. And so Deborah asked me to do the video as a way to start expanding the impact of the university into the community. It's one of those wonderful ideas that didn't quite get born. But the video came out of discussions on the North State Initiative.
My guest is Brooks Thorlakson, and she teaches a class for OLLI, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, on the Book in Common on the Chico State campus, and was largely responsible for this whole idea of a Book in Common. May I say that, Brooks?
Well, probably not. I was certainly one of the voices, but it was a collaborative effort.
But you did serve on a committee, made the selection.
Right.
Who else was on the committee? Well, because when you say we selected,
yeah,
you
in the
and...
In the beginning, there was a small group of faculty who decided they wanted to do this. And I must tell you, back 16 years ago, I don't remember everyone who was on it. A lot of people from the English department, of course.
And what was your field at the university?
I was in the English department, yeah. And then when we decided to take it big, it was clearly because of the leadership of Bill Locher, who is still there as the coordinator of the Book in Common. He saw the potential, and when I was working with him, he said, "Yeah, let's do it." And so I was able to work with Bill Locher and Thea Wolf, who's the coordinator of the First Year Experience Program, both of whom were interested in ways that students would be able to be involved in a project bigger than their own class or their own project.
Well, if you are, say, an English teacher and you want your students to read this book, you can assign it as required reading for a course. You can't do that out in the community. You can't say to the average student, person walking down the street, the average citizen, "Oh, here's a book you should read." So how do you go about convincing people that this is a worthwhile thing to do?
Well, the first thing you do is start your own book club, which is what I did. And so I had a book club of 10 people that I could read with. But when I retired, I worked with Ann Nicolai, who's the coordinator of the Osher Lifelong Learning Program. We call it OLLI. And I told her that I would miss the Book in Common. And she said, "Well, don't miss it. Do it." And so since I retired, I've been teaching the course. I teach it like a book club. So we only meet 3 times. I organize the course so it ends with the visit from the author. And I tell everybody in the class, this is a book club where you bring your background, your experience, your belief, what you think about to the text. So I don't quote, teach, end quote the book. I don't say this is what the book is doing. I ask people to read the book, and then I say to them, what does the book mean to you? Now, this particular year, I'm going to focus our discussion on what does the book ask us to do? And so as we're reading Stevenson's words, I'm going to be sensitive to what is he saying to us and what should we do with it, with this information? The answers can be quite broad. It can be a personal decision. It can be a political decision. There are all kinds of things to do, but I'm going to ask the people who read the book to see it as a book that asks something of us as those who read it.
Well, is this the third year you've conducted this, Ollie?
Yes, it is.
For the Book in Common. Well, at the end of, or I think it was the end of your video that you made, you asked, what are the solutions? What can we do? Now, that was for the book on water, but it seems like that's the question each year. What are the solutions? What can we do?
Yeah, and that's sort of where I live. I'm one of those people that likes to have a job and likes to have a project, and I sort of live there. But if you look at the kinds of books we're choosing, they're about people who are making a difference in the world. And I don't think we did this intentionally. In fact, I know we didn't. Bill Locher manages a committee of people that are representative of the university, Butte College, the library system, and the community. They read 20 books in the fall semester to pick the book. So it's quite a wide variety of people with a wide variety of points of view. But we end up, it seems, if you look at the list, books about people who make a difference. And to me, the next step is, well, what can I do? How can I join in?
Well, for example, Steve Lopez's book about the homeless guy, then that's the question, what are the solutions? What can we do? And we're still wrestling with this, with the homelessness here in Chico. And so your question for, in that case, the book about water, what are the solutions and what can we do? It seems like it applies to all the books that you have chosen.
Yeah, and I think that you'll see, as if you read the book by Stevenson, you'll see that he is clearly asking questions that are broad enough that they're going to go back and help us understand the question of homelessness. They're going to understand the question of the community's need to participate in decisions about water or rare sources, resources. So it's kind of, maybe it's a human question. What do we do?
My guest is Brooks Thorlakson, and she was instrumental in getting the book in common off and running here in the Chico community. She teaches a class for the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on the Chico State campus, which she calls a book club. So this is a huge book club. And you mentioned the members of this club, so to speak, California State University, Chico, Butte College, the Public Library. Who else has input or participates?
You know, an awful lot of book clubs in Chico wait to hear what the book in common will be. The library has done a fabulous job of putting together book club packets, 10 copies of a book. So once the book is selected, then the library buys books, the public library, and so book clubs can actually get the book that way. Of course, they can buy them in the bookstores as well. Depending on the book, some of the public schools and the local schools participate. If the teachers feel that the book is one that meets some of the criteria for their classes. So I would say in Butte County, we've done a really good job of getting the book into the air so people are aware of it. You mentioned earlier that the talk at Lackson on April 19th is sold out, which is fabulous. And this is like way a month ahead. And so we did that one other time. We sold out the Mortenson talk. So it is a way that sort of quantifies how many people care about the book, but also care about the issue, because the issues raised by Brian Stevenson's book are pretty big and pretty. It's a tough book to read. It's a tough book when you think about what's happening, and if you ask yourself, "What's my role? What is my role in this issue?"
But he doesn't do it in a way. Some people, when they have a cause, are I know a woman that was described as a firebrand, but he does it in a way that he tells you a story. He makes this person human. And there's a book that I thought of when, and I was reading Bryan Stevenson's book, a woman, Baz Dreisinger, traveled around the world, and her book is called Incarceration Nations, and she traveled around to various prisons, and she said she was repeatedly amazed by the intelligence, humanity of the prisoners she meets. And that's what Bryan Stevenson does for us as a reader. He makes these people human. She said that she found this everywhere she went, the dehumanization of incarceration. And she also said the ineffectual senselessness of punishment. And that's what Mr. Stevenson makes us aware of.
And I think you're right. He doesn't do it in a way that bangs you on the head. Instead, early on in the book, he invites us to, he says, this is a book about getting close to mass incarceration and extreme punishment. And if you think about that, think about wrapping your mind around the idea of mass incarceration. One of the things he talks about is in the 70s, I think it was 700,000 people were in jail in this country. And now it's like 3 million. We have more people in jail, in prison in this country than any other country in the world. And when you stop and look at why people are in jail, it will blow your mind. The range is incredible. Stevenson talks in his book about children, the ages of 12 and 13, being sentenced to life in prison or execution. That's in this country. Now, he went before the Supreme Court, and he was able to get that overturned for children under 12. But think about the 12-year-old kids you know. Wrap your arms around the idea of that child going to San Quentin for the rest of his or her life. And that's what Stevenson does in the book. He gives you the picture, and he invites you to live in that image. So when you meet some of the characters in the book, I shouldn't say characters, some of the real people that he has worked with, if you just sit there peacefully and quietly and imagine their lives. And I must say that I said to myself as I read it, not only do I have to get close to those people who are unjustly accused, I have to get very close to that prosecutor and that judge who did it. Because until we can get close to everybody in this situation, we will not fully understand it, and we will not be able to change it. And I do think that's one of the virtues of the book, is that he is so solid and so almost calm in the telling, even though he describes some of his own upheaval in dealing with it, you are really pulled into it in a very powerful way to understand that seeing the pictures he draws really affects you. It really gets into your mind and actually into your heart, which is, you need both for this to have the right impact.
My guest is Brooks Thorlakson, and I've invited her here to talk about this year's Book in Common specifically, the Book in Common in general, but specifically the book Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption by Bryan Stevenson. And we've read his book, and you are pointing out some of the things that I think he would hope that the reader would latch on to, would notice. And it is so engaging. He's such a wonderful storyteller.
Yeah, he really does. And it's because the story comes out of his life. He grew up in a community of poor Black people without options. And he says in the book that when he finally discovered his calling, he was 23 and he'd gone to the South and he had discovered some of this inequity that the book is about. And he just felt like he'd come home, and he realized that his life's work came out of his childhood, where he always wondered, why is it that people are judged and treated unfairly? And he experienced this as a boy.
His own grandfather was murdered.
His grandfather was murdered, and as he says in the book, nobody cared. There was no high school in his neighborhood. Life was really, really hard, and he didn't know what he wanted. He was a very bright young man. He'd gotten into very good schools. And when he did an internship and met a man on death row, it's like the lights went on in his head and he knew what his life was about. And it was because he was so concerned, and I think the words are really important. Why and how are people judged unfairly? It's a very important concept to think about. And it, again, it applies to many levels. It applies to the homeless person on the street. It applies to somebody on death row. It applies as we're meeting new people and we judge them and we think, well, you know, she's a wacky old lady. People say that about me. But it's a message that reverberates on every level. And I think that's why the book is so powerful, because it is about mass incarceration. It is about the death penalty. But it's also about being human. It's also about the choices we make on a day-to-day basis about what we believe in and how we're going to live our lives. I think you nailed the tone so right, Nancy, in that it doesn't tell you what to think. He is posing questions. He's giving you stories. But unlike me, he's not going to tell us what to think. I, however, will tell you exactly how to think about these things.
My guest is Brooks Thorlakson. She's retired from the university, from Chico State University, 3 years ago, but continues to be interested in the book in common and to teach a class or heads a book club for Osher Lifelong Learning. What is the point of reading the book in common?
Well, I think books in common are a valuable thing to do simply because it extends a conversation. It gives an opportunity for people from diverse areas, from diverse communities, from diverse points of view. It gives us an opportunity to look at something from another point of view. So I will come to a book with a certain perspective. Let me use an example from my class last semester. We read the book The Distance Between Us, which was the last book in common by mm-hmm. Reina Grande, which was also a fabulous book, I must say.
She has an amazing story, doesn't
she? It was a wonderful story. Yeah. And in my class, we were talking about the book, and there was a woman in the room who told us about her life growing up in Texas, where she was often picked up by the Border Patrol because they said, well, you're probably a Mexican who's escaped across the border. And she was a third-generation American. She was picked up because of how she looked. And it was so powerful for the people in the classroom who had not had that experience to meet somebody who'd had that experience. And that's the kind of that's the reason a book in common is useful, is that it allows us to pool our experiences and, in effect, to have more experiences than one life allows.
Well, when I was, speaking of this personal background experience, when I was reading Brian Stevenson's book, Just Mercy, about the situation in the South, I grew up in the South. I was born in Georgia. Well, by the time a lot of these things happened, I had already gone off to college and I wasn't living there anymore. But it was just heartbreaking for me on a personal level to realize that the culture that I grew up in, now not my friends or their family, but to know that I was living in a state that was like that. Now, Brian Stevenson's story is in Alabama that he mostly talks about. And of all ironies, Monroeville, Alabama, where To Kill a Mockingbird was set and
exactly.
Atticus Finch lived. But I was particularly touched by this story because of my own where I grew up. And it's just so heartbreaking.
Well, you know, I was a VISTA volunteer back in the late 60s. And I went to Richmond, Virginia from California. And I was stunned by the racism. There were still blood banks that were called colored blood banks. There were drinking fountains, drinking fountains. But one of the things that struck me, even though I was living, they called it the mouth of the South. It was 100 miles from Washington, but Richmond was a southern city. But what struck me is that while it's easy for us to think of the South as the home of racism, and it certainly was the home of the deep kinds of divisive racism, I think it's instructive to remember. In fact, I had a friend in Richmond. His name was John. And he told me he'd lived in the North for a while. And he said, you know, the only difference between the North, and certainly the West was considered the North.
Oh, yeah. Yankees.
Yeah. He said the only difference, he said, here in the South, they'll let us get as close as we want, but they don't let us get too big. He said, up there in the north, you'll let us get as big as we want, but you won't let us get too close.
What an interesting distinction.
Well, it was a very important distinction for those of us who'd come into Richmond thinking we were going to help the world to really examine our lives. And while I did not come from a community that had any Black community people, there were Native Americans who were completely marginalized. And, I mean, when you look at the history of Northern California, there are pockets of African Americans, Weed, for example, and McLeod and Quincy, but not the valleys between, so Bernie. Well, the reason is that the people who came out from Alabama and Arkansas, if they worked with African Americans and they came out to California to set up mills, they would bring African American workers, and they peopled Weed and McLeod, or Quincy, the mill in Quincy. But the fellow who started the mill in Bernie only worked with white people in the South. And so where I grew up in Bernie, Fall River, MacArthur, it was a very white community. But if you move to the valley north or south, so there's so many things that history can teach us about why we're like we are and allow us to possibly make new decisions about what we think and what we do.
Yeah, because when I was growing up, it wasn't examined. That was just the way things were, the way it had always been. And there was no sense of urgency to change. And I think books like this will help change that. Thank you so much, Brooks, for coming in and talking about this year's Book in Common. After a short break, I'll be talking to the author, Brian Stevenson, of this year's Book in Common. He is the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, a legal practice dedicated to defending the poor and wrongly condemned in our criminal justice system. He will be at Laxon Auditorium in Chico on April 19th. But because Laxon Auditorium is completely sold out, Chico Performances is offering tickets to watch a live simulcast of the lecture from the Harlan Adams Theater. And student tickets are free. Non-students are $5. There will also be a free live simulcast of the lecture in Reading at Old City Hall and Grass Valley in the Public Library. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest has been called a real-life, modern-day Atticus Finch, who through his work in redeeming innocent people condemned to death has sought to redeem the country itself. Desmond Tutu called Brian Stevenson America's Nelson Mandela. Mr. Stevenson is also an author, and his book about mass incarceration America, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, is this year's Book in Common. He's founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit committed to fighting poverty and challenging racial discrimination in the criminal justice system. He has argued 5 times before the Supreme Court and is the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School and is on the faculty at New York University School of Law. Brian Stevenson, welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf. Your book, Just Mercy, is about mass incarceration. That's a tough sell. So what compelled you to write this book?
Well, I'm just persuaded that if people saw what I see on a regular basis, if they understood the things that I've learned over the course of my career, they would really want change. What we're doing in many parts of this nation is simply unacceptable. We're just tolerating abuse and cruelty and injustice in ways that I don't think most people would accept, but there's this information gap. And the book was really an attempt to bridge that gap, to get people closer to the realities of mass incarceration and to, I think, the shame of what's happened to too many people for too long.
Well, you know what I like is that you shake us out of our indifference with a story. And what was this story that got you started on this path?
Well, I do think that narrative is really important. We understand things much more intimately when they're framed by narrative. That certainly would happen to me. I was a law student about to reconcile myself to a career as a lawyer that I knew was not going to be fully affirming, not going to be terribly gratifying when I went to Georgia to work with lawyers representing people on death row. And it was meeting a condemned man who was burdened with chains, handcuffs on his wrists, shackles on his ankles, a chain around his waist, and seeing him respond to just my presence, to just being told that he wasn't at risk of execution any time in the next year, to see how, even in my ignorance, I could have an impact on the quality of this man's life was really quite powerful for me. And then we had this long conversation where we were just talking and discovering that we weren't so different before guards came into the room and treated him pretty roughly, threatened him, and were putting the handcuffs on very tightly. And before they forced him out of the room, this man looked at me and he said, Brian, don't worry about this. You just come back. And I write in the book about how this man then did something I've never forgotten. He closed his eyes, he threw his head back, and he started to sing. And he sang this old hymn, I'm pressing on the upward way, new heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound. And then he said, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. And that man's song changed me. I really knew that I wanted to help condemned people get to higher ground, but mostly I knew that my journey to higher ground was tied to his journey. And it's experiences like that that have absolutely shaped my relationship to the work that I do, to my mission, my purpose, my career. And I think that's what narrative can do. That's what experience can do. It can make you step away from indifference and activate you in ways that I think can be absolutely transformative.
Because you write that you weren't even a lawyer yet. You were just a law student. You go in to meet this man thinking, what in the world am I going to say to him? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And he reassured you.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's the real challenge, Nancy. I think that we've got to get proximate to the places and the people who are oftentimes marginalized, who are abused, who are neglected. We think that we can solve problems from a distance, and our solutions don't work because to really be effective, you've got to get proximate. We've been taught, many of us, that if there are bad schools in our community, if there are places where there's violence and despair or drug addiction and dependency, if there are areas where there's abuse and neglect, to stay as far away from those places as possible. I think if we want to change the world, if we want to create more justice, we've actually got to get proximate to the problems. I got proximate to condemned people, and what I learned was that I could actually make a much bigger difference than I thought I could. There's power in proximity, and that man taught me that, and my clients have been teaching me that over the last 30 years.
Well, I was struck by John Stewart's words. He said, discussion of this topic has been white people yelling at each other.
Yeah, I don't think we've done a very good job of even creating a forum for honest discussion. I think we've really been corrupted by what I call the politics of fear and anger. Our politicians have been competing with each other over who can be the toughest on crime, and that has facilitated a discourse that's not even about correction or recovery or rehabilitation or good policymaking or good governance. It's just about showing how tough we are. And whenever a society allows itself to be led by fear and anger, it will tolerate abuse. It will tolerate injustice. And we've seen that in the criminal justice system for the last 40 years. I'd like to think that we're turning a corner now, but it's not inevitable. We've got to have people change that narrative of fear and anger and embrace something more redemptive, more hopeful, more integrated into our values and norms and morals as a larger society.
And you make the point that when a mistake is made, we don't like the arrows pointed out. We can resist confronting them. And it took 6 years to get a court to overturn Mr. McMillan's conviction.
One of my great frustrations is that our legal system is much more committed to finality than it is to fairness. And you see that in these cases where there is oftentimes obvious evidence of a wrongful conviction, And courts and judges are too frequently looking for reasons to avoid having to correct these mistakes. I don't know why we don't have conviction integrity units in every state, in every prosecutor's office. I don't know why a prosecutor thinks that his or her role is to just maintain the status quo. If there's a problem, we all benefit by correcting that problem, but we don't have that consciousness yet in our criminal justice system, and that's one of the great challenges. Our system is really unreliable right now. I am persuaded that we have more innocent people in jails and prisons today than we have ever had in our history. You cannot go from 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 and 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today and not have a corresponding increase in the number of innocent people wrongly convicted, particularly where I think we still have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, is shaping outcomes in too many jurisdictions.
My guest is Brian Stevenson, and he wrote a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And in some cases, you have to go to the court of last resort, 60 minutes. You have to go to TV and tell the story on television. You refer to that as the court of last resort.
Well, I do think that there is this barrier between what happens in jails and prisons, what happens in courts, that shields people from understanding what's going on, and transparency and exposure and revelation are key components to how we're going to get reform. In the McMillan case, which I detail, we went to 60 minutes not because I think it was going to be key to winning the case, but we couldn't create a narrative about Mr. McMillan's wrongful conviction through the local press. We have, I think, in too many places, this kind of entanglement between the media and local law enforcement and local power structures where everybody protects the dominant narrative, which is that we don't make mistakes, we always get the right person, there is no unfairness, inequality, or injustice in our system. And when media becomes complicit in reinforcing that narrative, even when it's not true, you got to shake things up. And there are a handful of entities and institutions and national perspectives that have made shaking things up a little easier. It's in some ways easier today because the internet has, I think, given us all a little bit more access to create counter narratives in places where they're desperately needed.
Well, you mentioned, you tell the story, for example, of Walter McMillan and other stories of adults, but you also, there are stories about children, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. One of the real tragedies of the last quarter century, 40 years or more, is what we've done to kids. I mean, we created a narrative in America that there are some children that are not children. They may look like kids, they may act like kids, but we said these are not children. We came up with a new term in the 80s. We said that these are, quote, super predators. We use that rhetoric, that language, to justify horrific policies. There are now 14 states with no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. We've got thousands of young kids in adult jails and prisons where they're at risk of being sexually assaulted and victimized. We've put tens of thousands of kids into adult prisons for decades. And I think we just gave up on a generation of children, mostly black and brown kids, and the consequence of that is really shameful. And I document the pain and the anguish I've seen when 14-year-old boys are put in jails where they're sexually assaulted and abused, or where kids are put in circumstances where they are denied the opportunity to develop as healthy human beings. And some of what's happened in that arena is nothing less than cruel and barbaric.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you give these people a name for us. You tell their stories, because I was born and raised in Georgia, and my dad was like other people of his generation in that culture. As long as we called them colored people, those other people. But when it came to someone he knew,
right,
a friend, he was so compassionate, and he recognized the injustice, but
yeah,
he had to know that person and know them by name. And I think that's what you've done for us.
Well, I think it really is the great power of literature and storytelling. I've seen that dynamic that you described with your father with lots and lots of people. I think we're all much more motivated to stand up for people when they're being unfairly treated, to intervene, to say things that need to be said, when we recognize that someone we know, someone we care about, our brothers, our sisters, our neighbors, are being mistreated. It becomes personal to us because they are personal to us. And the one thing I wanted to do was to make the clients, the children I've represented, the adults I've represented, the women I've represented who've gone to prison at such astonishingly high rates. We've had a 640% increase in the number of women being sent to prison in the last 20 years. I wanted all of those people to be known and knowable to readers because I am persuaded that, like your dad, the more we become aware, the more intimate we become with the community of people who are being victimized, the less acceptable their victimization is. And we need some of that outrage, some of that indignation to create the moral courage, I think, that's going to be required to dismantle mass incarceration and excessive punishment.
My guest is Brian Stevenson. He is a lawyer, an attorney, and he has written a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. One of the touching stories you tell in your book is a condemned man's last day, and all day long, what do you want for breakfast? And what was his reaction?
You know, it really was challenging. It was an early case that I did, and we'd had such success in blocking executions that when we couldn't block this one, it was very difficult. And I went down to be with him before the execution. This was at the time when they still used the electric chair in Alabama. And he was telling me just how strange the day had been. And when I got back there, it was just a few minutes before the execution, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange. All day long, people have been asking me, what can I do to help?" He said, "When I woke up, they asked me, what do you want for breakfast? At midday, they said, what do you want for lunch? In the evening, they said, what do you want for dinner?" And he said, "They kept coming to me saying, what can I do to help? Can I get you stamps to mail your last letters? Can I get you water? Can I get you coffee? Can we get you the phone to call your friends?" And this man said to me in those last few minutes, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange." He said, "More people have asked me, what can I do to help you in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did in the first 19 years of my life." And I was holding his hands thinking, yes, where were they when you were 3 years old and your mom died? Where were they when you were being physically abused? Where were they when you were being assaulted? Where were they when you were drug addicted and homeless? I know where they were when you were accused of this crime. They were lined up to execute you. And that difficulty, that disconnect was really, really challenging for me to have this man have the hair shaved off his body, then pulled away, strapped into an electric chair and executed was difficult, but it was almost our inability to recognize that more could have been done, should have been done at a time when it had been meaningful. That was the real hard takeaway for me. And I vowed to him that we would fight harder to get people the help they need, to engage in work that could prevent these tragic outcomes. And it's been the direction of the work we've tried to pursue here at the Equal Justice Initiative.
Well, you're a graduate of Harvard Law School. You could have had a comfortable life like your classmates, I'm sure. What keeps you going?
You know, I really believe that justice is a constant struggle, and if you don't struggle to fight for the things that are important, you're going to see retreat, you're going to see injustice. And I think seeing what I've seen, knowing what I know, I really couldn't be comfortable doing anything else. I don't feel for me like there's a choice. If you see something that you can fix, if you see someone you can help, and you know that if you don't fix it and if you don't help, there's going to be suffering and pain, you just do it because you have to. It would be hard to live. It would be hard to be at peace without doing that. And I think that's what's happened to me. And I feel in many ways that's been modeled for me by generations of civil rights activists, people who stood when other people told them to sit down, people who spoke when other people told them to be quiet. They have modeled for me the necessity of giving voice to the things that need to be heard. But more than that, they've modeled for me the power that you feel, the energy that you gather when you stand in the place that you think you are required to stand in the name of justice, in the name of what's right. And I often feel that sense of empowerment, that energy, and that makes it much easier for me to do the things that I do, to keep fighting, to do work, than it would be for me to be silent, to stop, to just be quiet.
Well, I want to personally express my personal appreciation for the work that you do, Mr. Stevenson. And we will look forward to your visit to Chico on April 19th and look forward to having you here in our community where we are reading your book as a book in common, The Community of Chico.
Well, thank you so much for that. I look forward to meeting everybody in Chico when I arrive.
The crime of human trafficking is being recognized today more than any time in history. Next Tuesday, on the Chico State campus, there will be a training seminar on human trafficking featuring trafficking survivor Carissa Phelps. This training, sponsored by the Central California Intelligence Agency, is free and open to the public. By age 12, Carissa Phelps had run away from home, dropped out of school, and fled into the arms of a brutal pimp. Her life was transformed through the unexpected kindness of a teacher and counselor. By the time she turned 30, Carissa had graduated from UCLA with both a law degree and an MBA. She is now an attorney, author, and expert on domestic human trafficking. The title of her book is Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. Carissa Phelps, welcome. Well, first of all, what is human trafficking? Is it the same as sex trafficking?
No, human trafficking is, I think of it as like a larger umbrella where, yes, sex trafficking is a part of that. Beneath that umbrella, but human trafficking involves all sorts of labor, debt bondage, and it's more widely defined and encompasses more than just sex trafficking.
Well, that sounds so removed from my world that I think, well, that doesn't affect me. So what do you say to people who don't think this is a problem?
It's unfortunately, this is something that people have done for probably throughout history in terms of exploiting other individuals and their vulnerabilities for their own profit or benefit. And it happens in households. So it could be a neighbor. It happens in restaurants and businesses that we frequent, and happens all around us. And it's not only to foreign victims, although foreign victims are targeted sometimes for their vulnerability. It also happens to our own children, our own citizens in the United States.
So that's hard for me to believe. A nice community like Chico, this would be a problem. So how would I even recognize it? How could it be so invisible to me?
I think that people generally try to hide the trafficking. The traffickers, obviously, they're criminals, and so they're trying to hide what they're doing from the untrained eye. So they're not going to give off signs necessarily that they're being trafficked. In other words, they don't bring people in on chains and leashes necessarily. And so they will appear that the trafficked victim is free to go anytime. And that oftentimes just tricks our mind to believe that they're there by choice, which is, you know, kind of an inference we make. It's just, okay, they don't have chains on, so they must want to be there. And we don't see the fact that maybe their documents have been taken from them. Maybe their families have been threatened. Maybe their children even have been taken from them and held hostage in order to force this behavior that's going on. So those threats are real. Force is real in terms of maybe what we don't see that's happening physically to them, where we're not seeing it. We don't see the cuts and bruises and the harm that's being done, but there are physical harms that are being done to them, including starvation or withholding food or physical abuse and assault. All those are very, very common things, and we might not necessarily see those bruises because they're behind the hairline or they're underneath the clothes or being hidden, much like a domestic violence victim. And on top of that, besides the criminal wanting to cover it up, oftentimes there is a tremendous amount of shame involved in being a victim of trafficking, both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. You could feel a tremendous amount of guilt that builds up to shame, actually, where you feel like there's something wrong with you, what you were a target because somehow you're weaker or you did something wrong. And that could lead the victim to even hiding the fact that they are a victim.
My guest is Carissa Phelps, and she is an expert on domestic human trafficking. And it's hard to believe that the person who is being the victim, how do they get sucked into something like that? How do they let themselves get abused, taken advantage of?
And I think your key language there is, you know, how do we let ourselves, and it's not a matter of letting ourselves, it's really a matter of somebody with a criminal intent targeting people who possibly have vulnerabilities. But if they don't have vulnerabilities, it's this criminal intent of creating vulnerabilities so that they can profit and exploit and profit off of that human being. So maybe there's someone who's from a secure family overseas who sees coming to the United States as an opportunity. And this is very common, you know, that it seems like maybe they would have more opportunity to work here in the United States. So they try to talk to recruiters or people who could get them over here. They may be lied to. They may have money taken from them in their home country where they were feeling very secure. They were secure in their home country. They could have their house taken from them, their money taken from them, and then they get here to the United States, and they're very limited on resources, and they're here illegally because of the criminal intent of the recruiter that lied to them and said, you know, we're getting your documents squared away, we're giving you an opportunity in the United States, and they get here, and they're trapped. They don't have any money back home. They don't have any more resources. They feel that shame and guilt like they were tricked, and they don't, and they think they could work their way out of the debt because that's what they're told, and they never can. So there's a tremendous amount that goes on in terms of the victim psychology, but also just in terms of the criminal intent, the criminal psychology of just what they try to create in terms of vulnerabilities and what they try to exploit in terms of vulnerabilities of the victim.
Well, this sounds like slavery.
It very much is, mm-hmm. and it's unfortunate that people don't know that it still exists globally, but also in our own neighborhoods.
If we suspect, I mean, how do you even approach somebody? What can you do?
You know, case after case where victims have actually been identified and actually have been able to receive services and get out is because of citizens that are out there, because of individuals who are out there who see with their eyes, who recognize that something is off or wrong, and who report it to trained individuals and trained law enforcement and trained first responders who can then get the resources and services to the victim and then address the criminal, the crime of human trafficking as well, and shut down these enterprises. So it's very important that as a community we're trained to identify this, because that's how people get help and that's how they get out, is because community members are trained, they're attuned, they understand, they see, and they report, and they know where to report to.
So I might remind people that you are going to be conducting a training seminar that is coming up next Tuesday on the Chico State campus, and it is free. It's open to the public. It's a training seminar that you are conducting, and this is not just an exercise in something that you don't know anything about, because you actually experience this. Your book, Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. Somebody said about your book, after reading your book, no child should have to endure what Carissa did, but thousands do. That's staggering. Thousands go through what you went through. So this seminar then is for, I'm guessing, parents, for teenagers, maybe especially girls.
Girls and boys, yes. It's definitely for parents. It's for business owners. It's for anyone who is out in the community, volunteers, people who are community resource people who are in the medical profession who see and oftentimes are first responders. Everyone you can think of can play a role in both identifying and stopping human trafficking and also helping to respond to it and build the resources in our community so that when a victim is identified, they don't have to feel like ostracized and pushed out, but they could feel welcomed into the community and receive the resources and services that they so desperately need so that they are not vulnerable and re-victimized.
Well, I do want to mention that your book, even if somebody thinks, well, this is something that is too vast for me to even have any impact, but your book is such fascinating reading. I mean, good grief. I could see it as a movie that you came from a family that when you start your story, you say 10 kids, soon to be 11. Your mother was going to have a baby. And your mother's story, too. She was abandoned when she was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And she ran away with who was your father when she was 14. She got married when she was 16. I mean, that's just, that's a tough start. And then, because she was a Jehovah's Witness, your family didn't celebrate birthdays or Christmas or Easter. Then your sister, you had a sister named Emily, who decided she didn't want to be a part of the family, and she was granted legal emancipation. Did you ever think of doing that yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely something that I understood. You were no longer a child in my household after you became a teenager. And then it's unfortunate that many people see young adolescents and young children as adults too soon. We are not aware of all of the elements out in the world and all of the predators that are out there. As many times as you can tell a child to be safe, they don't know what predators look like necessarily when they come, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing, if you would, but they, you know, they come to you selling you a dream or selling you something that you want to believe is real. And you're a child. And unfortunately, I was led to believe, you know, when I was a child that I was all grown up after, you know, only being a teenager, only being 12, 13 years old, that I was somehow grown up enough to make some decisions on my own. And that was not the case.
Yeah, I can imagine myself at 12 years old. It would be easy for some stranger to convince me that he would take care of me or that my life would be better if I followed what he said. I could see that at 12. Is that what happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of people that came in, but unfortunately, it was after sexual abuse, it was after sexual assault on the streets that had been unaddressed, and so anything looked better than that. And I kept trying to escape to go from something that seemed a little better than what my circumstances were, and it kept getting worse. And that's what I see, unfortunately, many youth trapped in, is that once they are expelled from school or once they are kicked out from society, labeled in a certain way, then they end up with fewer and fewer options that are healthy, and they end up with fewer and fewer protective factors, almost like they're kicked out of society. And then they're preyed upon and they're vulnerable, and that's boys and girls. So that's where we all can play a role, I think, in creating a more comprehensive plan and a response for when children are victimized in the first place on how to keep them in the community and keep them safe instead of pushing them out of the community and making them less safe.
Well, your life certainly could have taken a different direction, and it's nice that you did have a successful career. I might remind people that name of your title of your book is Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Chico
Thank
on
you.
April 12th.
And I hope that on your site you can put on some of the reporting numbers that people can call, the human trafficking hotline and the CSIC website, the SACRTAC.org website, where people can make reports.
Yes, we'll do that.
Okay.
Attorney Carissa Phelps will be presenting a free training seminar on human trafficking April 12th on the Chico State campus. I would also like to thank Brooks Thorlakson, who teaches a class on the Book in Common, and this year's Book in Common author, Attorney Brian Stevenson, whose memoir, Just Mercy, is a bestseller about the criminal justice system. He will be in Chico on April 19th. Because Laxon Auditorium is sold out, Chico Performances is offering tickets to a live simulcast of Mr. Stevenson's lecture from Harlan Adams Theater. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.